So thanks for being here.
Oh, of course. The first time I ever took a domestic flight in the United States was in 2012 to come to the Socialism Conference. So basically, most of my travel has just been to Chicago, and most of what I've seen in Chicago has just been lovely McCormick. Everything from Chinatown to hair is what a city.
Yeah, Chicago is more or less the same. So yeah, you've been coming here for a while. Are you enjoying yourself this weekend?
Yeah, I think it's incredible that this is probably more people than I've ever been. You know the numbers.
It's up there, yeah.
Than I've ever been at a conference, and a lot of the people are new to the Socialism Conference, which is great because I think a lot of people are also new to this movement. When I joined DSA in 2007, we had 5,000 people in a country of 320 million. Now there's, 60,000 in a country of 330 million. Right. So we're making progress. We're growing at a faster rate than the national population.
So by what year will we have a gym?
I'll leave demographic mongering to the right. Yeah. I'm not sure. But I do think that obviously it's inspiring because a lot of what we have been doing, a lot of what Jason's been doing, so Jason's working at Jackson for a couple years, and before that he worked at Haymarket, so two of the sponsors of the event here, and a lot of it has been at first conceived as keeping alive the flame of kind of not dead ideas but kind of defeated ideas, temporarily defeated ideas. I don't think we were wrong. I think defeated is the right word, and I conceived of it as kind of a project to keep alive some of the traditions of socialism to be useful someday in the future, and it's happened a lot quicker, at least revived movement, and that's exciting to see.
So I said this at the opening plenary, but we've been rebuilding this conference a little bit this year, and weren't sure about the attendance. I was hoping for 560 people to come out, 1,200 people registered, and then another 350, 400 people have walked in since. So it's like this is a huge conference. All the rooms are full and packed. We keep talking about the resurgence of socialism, that how many people are flocking to it, the size of DSA has grown so much. Why do you think that's been the case in the past couple of years?
Yeah, well, I think for one thing, obviously, if you have a society that's built on divisions, that's built on exploitation, that's built on oppression, that's bound to summon some sort of resistance, and I guess there has to be some sort of base level opposition, and socialism broadly conceived in all its different strains have been the primary kind of most serious threat to capital for the last 150, 160 plus years. So it's no wonder that it's going to make some sort of resurgence. So then there's obviously a lot of people who have been doing organizing, keeping alive this tradition. So in other words, I think that there would have definitely been this natural resistance to how particularly vicious capitalism is in the United States. But because of the actions of the thousands of people who didn't surrender, the thousands of people who were socialists and were committed to building socialist organizations, I think we were able to articulate some sort of coherent opposition to the left of liberalism that was called democratic socialism. So I think it still would have existed, but it might have used kind of vaguer, more left populist language. It might have just taken a different form. Then obviously you had Occupy, Black Lives Matter. People forget about the Wisconsin uprising in 2010 that kind of preceded Occupy. And then obviously there's a quirk of the Bernie Sanders campaign. I say quirk because there's been these periodic resurgences of kind of left candidates within the Democratic Party are running in the primaries and they come and go. I think Sanders was able to resonate with people, not in spite of him being a socialist. So this is often the liberal thing. Well, Sanders is good, but he has this anachronistic label, calls himself a socialist, and that must hamper his support. But in fact, I think regardless of what we think about his individual policy points here and there where we disagree with him, his worldview is clearly a worldview that was formed by in the socialist movement. It was clearly a worldview that says to people that you're suffering and it's not your fault. The reason why you're not getting enough isn't because of minorities, it's not because of immigrants, it's because of millionaires and billionaires, and we need to take something from them and create a political revolution and take back kind of our wealth and power and build a better country. And again, we could disagree with the particulars of some parts of his vision, but that core argument is something that's familiar to every socialist of every stripe. And I think that's part of the power. Like, our ideas can resonate in part because they are based on a simple truth. And sometimes in theory and in kind of discerning kind of concrete details, we lose sight of the simple underlying truth that actually has made socialism so compelling to so many people in so many different contexts all over the world for so many decades.
Mm-hmm. So. This sort of brings me to a question about the book. In the first chapter, there's this sort of speculative fiction adventure for the working class about what socialism will look like in the year in a couple decades from now, like it sort of unfolds into the future. And we've talked a bunch about this at Jacobin, and you said this publicly about how oftentimes the case for socialism is often the case against capitalism. Which is right, we can articulate what's wrong with society, but do we have a mechanism for actually saying what we do want, what we can win, and what kind of society we should be building? So, I think the way that you pursued this was, it was far from utopian. You actually sort of laid out, like, this is what could happen in this year and this is what could happen next year. Why was it important to start the book with that sort of vision?
Yeah, so Marx himself was really opposed to the idea of writing recipes for the cookshops of the future. So basically, blueprinting out what an ideal society would look like. And that's because in the time he was making this criticism in the late 1840s and 1850s, the dominant strand within the socialist movement had been utopian socialists. And utopians broadly had the idea that you could, break off from the system and build your perfect ideal, and then people would kind of flock to you. It'd be like, if you build it, they will come, kind of view of creating communes and creating other societies built on a different basis. And then by example, changing capitalism. And utopian socialism has many different strands, but this was an important strand of it. And what the early Marxists were saying was, well, actually there's something particular about capitalism. Capitalism has given birth to an agent of change, the working class. It has given birth to the productive resources that make a society that's different than capitalism possible. And there was something that utopians didn't have kind of a agent of change, and it was more like a trans-historical ideal that didn't think about what particularly was different in capitalism. And so that was one criticism of that aversion to blueprinting came there. The other one was just because they were small D Democrats, in the sense that, if socialism is meant to be a movement based on the self-emancipation of working people, then it should be up to those working people, when that moment comes, to decide how they're going to structure society. It shouldn't be up to a small group of intellectuals and socialists today to make that decision. The reason, though, why I wanted to start with something that laid out what a alternative socialism that kind of meets our minimum definition of what socialism is because I think in the last few decades, people not only question whether socialism is politically possible or feasible, they question whether it's technically possible, because we've seen a lot of the failures of certain forms of central planning in the Soviet Union. We've seen kind of socialist attempts at socialism turn in authoritarian directions and so on. And I think there's that skepticism, not just from people who are opposed to the idea, but from working people that might be very much into a lot of the short-term causes that we're fighting for, might be into fighting against oppression, might be into kind of increasing wages and getting better conditions and so on. So with the first chapter, what I tried to do was lay out in a bizarre second-person narrative that half the readers hate, the other half seem to like. I try to explain the Marxist theory of exploitation, so explain why the capitalist workplace is unjust. Then explain how unions can mitigate this injustice, this exploitation at the heart of the capitalist workplace, but why this mitigation can only go so far within the confines of a single workplace. Then how, if we take the logic of a union and collective bargaining, but extend it to the level of, let's say, a nation or the state, how that society, social democracy could further mitigate forms of exploitation and decommodify. In other words, take away from the market certain things and have them be enjoyed as social rights, but how there's limits to that. I then explain how we can transition from a social democratic movement or society into a democratic socialist one, then what kind of a democratic socialist society would look like in the kind of minimum definition of a starting point. So in other words, some of these debates, how much markets do you have, how much planning do you have, and so on, these are often questions that we elevate to the level of principle when in fact a lot of this is technical. So in other words, in my view, the thing that distinguishes capitalism from other forms of society is market dependence. So in other words, all production is being done by kind of the elites who own the means of production is being done to produce commodities, to exploit labor, to commute commodities for sale in the market. Then for everyone else, they're formed to throw themselves, their ability to labor, into the labor market. But there was markets before capitalism, and there'll probably be markets after. So could we have a society in which there's no more market dependence, in which the core necessities of life are decommodified or taken out of the market exchange and are enjoyed as social rights, but for certain goods, like consumer goods, we still have worker-owned firms that are competing with each other in a marketplace, but the penalties for either for losing in market competition isn't destitution, it's just kind of just getting back to society and maybe going to another sector. Or on the other hand, you also have not just voice within your workplace, but also the ability to exit it. So in other words, it's meant kind of as a starting point and as a discussion for, you know, what would a kind of minimum feasible vision of socialism, still a society after capitalism. And that sounds somewhat modest or tame as a vision, but if you have a society without capitalists, if you have a society in which production is being produced by worker owners, where the core necessities of life are collectively and democratically controlled by society as a whole, then you have a society without class, and we've had class since the Neolithic Revolution or something like that. So we've been living in class societies for a very long time, and this could be, I think, we're at the point where the barriers to a different sort of society, a society without class, are just political, and it will take many, many decades of organizing and struggle and winning reforms and whatever else to get to the point where that's politically feasible. But I wanted to stress the idea that it was technically feasible. And the last thing I'll say is that, you know, I come from a anti-authoritarian democratic socialist tradition. So, you know, my tradition, democratic socialist tradition, never really saw the Soviet Union as a model at any point, even in its, you know, early days. But there was something to the power and confidence that working class people had in the United States and elsewhere across the world in the global south of being able to say there is a model and there's a model that works. And it gave people the confidence that all they needed to do is fight the landlords and fight the bosses, and they'd be able to win power and construct some sort of alternative. And I think we need a bit of that confidence back. And it's a bit depressing to think that, oh, we'll just win power, then elect a Syriza-like government or whatever else. You know, that's not enough enough confidence for people. So I do think there's a lot of efforts by David Schweikart, by even Michael Albert and others who have at the very least been putting forward these ideas and restarting these discussions.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of like raising people's expectations about what's possible, I mean, I think you structure the book in an interesting way because you talk about the future in the first chapter and the sort of the present in the last chapter, like what the immediate sort of what do we do right now. But the middle is all history. It's like a lot of deep history on, you know, on socialism from the beginning, going, you know, zigzagging across Europe, the developing world, into the United States. And it's, you know, to me at least, the takeaway is like we're trying to get to this future. Like you leave us with, what should we do? But like the history is something that we actually need to know and understand. And I think it's really important for people who are sort of newly coming into socialism, tens of thousands of people, to understand, you know, where we've been. You spend a bunch of time on Germany, and you talk about sort of like the mass. You know, the merger of the socialist movement and workers' party into a huge mass effort, but that creates like a different society, right? It's like it's so much different than the world we live in right now. When you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, you have, you know, dozens of newspapers, you have, you know, all different clubs, you know, the actual life and expectations and outlook of people can fundamentally change. Can you just like talk a little bit about that and what that looked like?
Yeah, so first of all, I didn't title this book. My publisher titled the book. And the middle portion is largely history. In part, it was because I wrote most of this book in like 3 to 4 months, and I had already spent my advance. And I just had to fill in some words. But in all seriousness, just the history chapter, there's only about 3,000 words or so of fluff, just filler, that should not be there to meet my minimum word count. And if any of you read the book, you could discuss with me afterwards and guess what the filler is. But what I wanted to avoid in that history section was the kind of no true Scotsman approach to socialist history. So often, you know, I'd be talking with like libertarian friends. I have like 2 libertarian friends. I met them both when I was 13 or 14 years old, around the time I was becoming a socialist, and they were becoming libertarians. And at the time, obviously, I thought, well, they just developed an ideology based on the worldview of like 13-year-old boys that grew out of it. They are now 29 and 30-year-old men, and they still have the same, you know, ideology. But so what often happens when we're in conversations is they'll sympathize when I talk about all the individual ills and failing of the systems. And I can say, you have medical debt, you have student debt, you hate your boss, you have to deal with all this kind of stuff in society. Aren't these injustices? And they'll agree at every single injustice that I bring up about the world. And actually, they're pretty good on issues being anti-war and things like that. But then I'll say, well, you're against all these individual symptoms of capitalism, so why aren't you anti-capitalist? Why aren't you a socialist? And they'll say, well, wait a second. This isn't capitalism. This is crony capitalism. You know, this is kind of not a society run by the market and by the dictates of bosses who produce things for the market. This is a society in which there's market failure because of state intervention and or whatnot. And so they'll never admit that any existing society is a capitalist society. And I think our parts of the broadly kind of anti-Stalinist socialist tradition will often do the same thing in our own way, where someone will bring up to me, oh, well, you know, I like democratic socialism. I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders, and I just went to Norway. It was great. And I'll be like, all right, that's not, you know, that's not a socialist. That's not, you know, a socialist society that has nothing to do with socialism. Or someone will bring up, well, you know, I would be a socialist, but, you know, my grandparents fled the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union was really authoritarian, and there was gulags and bread lines and whatever else. Socialism is bad. And then of course, you would say, well, of course that's not socialism. That has nothing to do with socialism, because socialism is good. So if that's bad, that has nothing to do with socialism. So I wanted to kind of take the approach that took all the different parts of the socialist tradition, found its common ancestor, and then talked about its successes and failures, and avoided kind of reading history backwards. So at every point, think about the constraints that actors were under, the pressures that they were under, and why they came to often the wrong decisions, but why they came to these decisions. So you could imagine socialist history as, well, there's this new class, this working class that emerges and that's becoming kind of a majority class all across the world. And this class is elevated to the very heights of power because capitalists are the class that have the power, but capitalists need workers. So we're brought to the points of in the production process where we can actually, we're within just arm's reach of the levers of power. And we're able to potentially shut down production and make demands that other classes are not able to do in the same way. You know, if a peasant withheld a peasant's like labor, that might just mean that peasant would starve and maybe a local landlord would suffer. But if a worker did it in a really important industry, that could have implications that would affect hundreds of thousands of people. But the relationship between labor and capital was a relationship of dependence, but it's an asymmetrical dependency in which any individual worker needed their money to buy food and housing more than any capitalist needed the labor contributions of that that worker. So if you go to your boss today and you say, I'm earning $12 an hour, I can't survive in Chicago on $12 an hour, I want $17 an hour, or I'm gonna quit, your boss would probably say, you know, bye-bye, you know, have a nice day. But if you went with 20 out of your 30 colleagues and you demanded the same thing, then you would actually have leverage. You have the ability to do something. But the boss's position of strength happens just because of the boss's position in the production process, whereas the worker has to take their abstract interests, they all have the same interest in a higher wage, and actually turn that into concrete kind of politics. They have to actually convince their colleagues to work together. They have to actually figure out a way, once they get, make their demands made, to make their organizations permanent, to form unions, and to form, create a strike fund, and that necessitates some sort of bureaucracy. And beyond that, you'll need to find a way to take your individual power in your workplace and then link up with workers across town and across your state and across your nation. And that might mean creating a national trade union federation. That's also very difficult. Then eventually you need to fight for political democracy and then actually win some demands from the state, and that requires forming a national political party, and that requires even more bureaucracy. So this is kind of the environment. It's actually a miracle that the workers' movement, within a few decades of its inception, is able to, all across the capitalist world, create mass parties that are fighting in the interests of working people. And then what happened to these parties? How did this necessary bureaucracy eventually become a conservatizing pull? How did kind of the rank and file democracy diminish? How did these conservatizing parties eventually kind of get to the point where a lot of the mass parties of the workers' movement voted for war credits in 1914, supported their particular governments in a slaughter that would kill 10 million plus people. And to explain that history, then explain, well, then what happened to this unified mass movement that seemed like it was on the cusp of winning power? So the left wing of the movement actually is able to take power, but they're able to take power only in underdeveloped countries where they're ravaged by civil war, famines, and the worst of conditions. So what happens when socialism becomes a question of holding out until the revolutions happen elsewhere, and also becomes the question of how do you take an underdeveloped country and develop it? And many of the things we hear about the Bolshevik Revolution are myths, in that we're often taught, at least in school in the US, to the extent you're taught it at all, it's kind of a coup done by a small group of professional revolutionaries. You know, that's not true at all. The Bolsheviks were a mass party that had roots primarily in the workers' movement, and it had a huge amount of support in the workers' movement. The only thing is, only 3% of Russia was you know, working class at the time. So you have a mass party in St. Petersburg and in Moscow and in other major cities, but you have to, once you take power, convince peasants who were with you when you were just telling them they would get some land, they would be able to fight the landlord, that they now have to subsidize the reindustrialization and development of a country. They have no interest in doing that. So what happens when socialism becomes, in other words, an ideology of development and modernization from above instead of an ideology of working class self-emancipation from below? Then what happens in the West when they discover, in a parallel way to what the Bolsheviks were discovering, that in fact it's really difficult to bring about socialism at a not just political but also a technical level? So in Germany in the 1920s, they had nationalization commissions, and they were earnestly socialists still in the SPD and the USPD that were trying to figure out, well, how do you take and nationalize companies and sectors and create a plan and do this kind of stuff? And they were at wit's end. And eventually, the model that social democracy developed, this kind of right wing of social democracy, was that they were going to administer doses of capitalism, socialism within capitalism. They were going to take certain spheres of life and decommodify them. They were going to improve wages and conditions by means of sectoral bargaining and all these other things, but they ultimately left the levers of control in the hands of capitalists. So capitalists, by the 60s and 70s, were able to say, well, this compromise that was working for us back in the 40s and 50s is no longer working for us now, and they were able to roll back the system. And I kind of get into these dilemmas. But the point of this history is to, you know, explain actions and the development of different wings of the socialist movement by the constraints that they were under, by the context they were in, then to figure out what lessons do we have from this. So, in particular, I have a friend of mine who's not at this conference, but Jonah Birch, who's a long time member of the ISO, and at one of these conferences a couple years ago, he said he wants a left that could learn from both 1917 Russia, but also 1976 Sweden, and that's kind of the spirit that was animating me in kind of these middle chapters. Then there's a chapter on socialism in America, because we obviously never even got to the point where we constructed a labor party that would later betray us. You know, we were never so lucky. But I wanted to, I think, remind people, especially people new to the socialist movement, that in fact, socialism has really deep roots here, and we were defeated by force. And many people have been struggling ever since to actually reach that point where we can have a party and we could have unions that are militant, that fights in the interests of working people, and also maintains the idea that there are distinct interests. Working people have distinct interests from their bosses, or even their managers, you know, not foremen. Foremen are, you know, are part of the workers' movement in other countries, but to kind of explain in this history, and also because my publisher wanted a book that was like, you know, AOC, Bernie, you know, all the kids, yay, kind of book. And I gave them this, like, 10,000 words in the German SPD. So one of the demands was you have to include at least one chapter on America.
I think people should look for that Bernie, yay book. Micah Utrecht, who's in the room, is working on that right now, coming from Verso. Whoop. I want to come back to social democracy, but I want to ask a real quick question, because I think this is important. You spend, there's a whole chapter that you didn't mention, which is about the developing world, right?
Yeah.
About Angola, about Mozambique, about Vietnam, about, you know, of course, China, Cuba. There's a number of other examples. And I just want to ask this really quickly, because I know we have to get back to the other stuff, but like, I thought it was really important that you mention that, both for the history, because we want to understand the history, but also because there's this, you know, it's you hear it less today, but it's still prevalent that like Marxism or socialism are, you know, they pertain to Europe. They're Eurocentric, they describe European conditions, they appeal to Europeans, and it's just not true. I mean, even, you know, when I say Latin America, you see Guatemala, you see all down, you know, everywhere, people adopting Marxism and rebelling and trying to implement socialism. Can you just, you know, I just talk about the importance of those struggles and why you put that in the book?
Yeah, I mean, generations of socialist leaders and thinkers and movements always just took for granted, you know, the fact that a lot of our reference points when we're talking about, let's say, 19th century socialist history or whatnot, are European reference points, not because of anything in European culture or whatever else, but because of simply the accident of capitalism first emerged there. And then later on, as part of national liberation movements to free countries of both underdevelopment and the muck of imperialism, which of course forced and created underdevelopment in a lot of these contexts, they looked particularly to the Russian example. Because the Russian state was, in a sense, like a proto-development state. So in the 1920s and 30s, there was this attempt to use the state to foster certain industries, to develop, to restore agricultural production, to do all these other things. And that was one model of development. And the other model was just, at the time, rampant kind of capitalist development. So even kind of right-wing developmental states in the global south look to elements of the Russian example for good and bad. And yeah, I think that history is really important. I think there's a lot of parallels to the dilemmas that face the China than to what happened in Russia earlier. So in China, the civil war happened before they took power, but you had the same thing where the Chinese communist movement was a urban-based, working-class-based movement in the 1920s, and they were literally massacred and forced to scatter into the countryside. And in the countryside, they developed a new base. It was a peasant base. But peasants wanted to produce on their own plot of land and to be free to do that and to sell a little bit of whatever extra product they had at market. And they were behind many of the initial reforms of the communists, but they resisted collectivization and they resist a lot of the other developments. So I think it's a very striking parallel to what happened in the Soviet Union. And again, sometimes we think about them as completely different experiments and traditions, but this isn't the way that the actual socialist, you know, thought of in the global South. And then just as far as like the old, you know, Eurocentrism argument, I think there's a big difference between saying that, you know, intellectually, if we're trying to study the emergence of capitalism, we're gonna focus on, let's say, England. And if we're going to try to study the early Industrial Revolution, we're focusing on England. And if we're trying to study the early workers' movement, we're focusing on movements from the Chartists and so on in England, but also the German Social Democratic Party. And then to say that we're being Eurocentric as opposed to just studying the early part of a phenomenon that still afterwards spread across the world. I mean, capitalism exists in every single corner of the world. There's no question of like a transition from feudalism to capitalism. No, it's just capitalism. And to the extent in some countries like India, you still see extreme underdevelopment, you still see landlords have a lot of power and whatnot. That's also just capitalism. That's a sign that capitalist development won't actually benefit, won't actually uplift you know, these billions of people you know, suffering in the global South, but it's not some sort of other system. And also, it's not simply a matter of culture. You know, there's nothing distinct about European culture that makes it more or less prone to socialism. I have like an Evernote file, or it's kind of, I don't know, people might know what Evernote is. And it's like, I have clips from the 1950s and 60s of New York Times and other outlets saying, well, you know, the Chinese spirit is by nature collectivist owing to its Confucian roots. Then I have another folder that's like clips from the 90s and 2000s of people like Thomas Friedman saying, well, Confucian culture has been a big boon in the liberalization of China, right? So like culture is pretty malleable and can mean a lot of things, and people are always gonna develop analysis that maybe overemphasizes certain things,
yep,
like that.
Yep. All right, so I have one last question and then we'll kick it over for discussion. Okay, so you end about this, where we go from here, but you invoke this term class struggle social democracy. So I've been a Leninist for a long time, and you know, the way we trained is that, you know, social democracy did like two things, right? One is that it killed Rosa Luxemburg and opened the door for the Nazis, and the second is that it's administered capitalism and it's not that great, right? So when you talk about class struggle social democracy, I think it seems to be a contradiction in terms from that point of view, right? But there's something that makes sense given, you know, what's going on in the world. I want you to sort of, I just want to draw out a little bit about that, and maybe I'll, you know, sort of poke you on certain issues. But what is, first of all, what is class struggle social democracy?
Okay, so first of all, most of the two things you said are true. But I guess the argument is, let's say if you were a socialist, like a revolutionary socialist, and you were transported back into the 1960s, what are the main complaints you would have had about social democracy? You would say that social democracy was taking rank and file militancy in the working class, and it was funneling that militancy towards electoral ends. And you would also say that social democracy was creating this, or creating an alliance with this trade union bureaucracy that was also doing something similar at the workplace level. And in the case of certain parties like the UK Labour Party, you would say that these social democratic movements and parties are now incorporating the workers' movement into the imperial project. So the UK Labour was the, you know, second best friend of US imperialism. So if you think today, let's say, about Jeremy Corbyn or Bernie Sanders, a lot of their demands are basic social democratic demands. Jeremy Corbyn says we need to renationalize the rail and other kind of vital parts of the British economy. Bernie Sanders says we need Medicare for all, and we need to kind of have universal child care and whatever else. A lot of these demands are just social democratic demands. But first of all, let's work backwards. On the question of imperialism, where do they stand? Well, British paratroopers are literally using the face of Jeremy Corbyn as target practice. There's a viral video to that effect. They have printed out pictures of Jeremy Corbyn and they shoot at it to practice their aim. So clearly to the people, you know, carrying out British imperialism, to the foreign policy elites, to the British generals who are saying things like vaguely threatening kind of a coup if Jeremy Corbyn is elected, or saying that the military he can't promise will be loyal, he's not a part of the imperial project, and the Labour left is not a part of this project. You know, they're slammed for being soft on Hezbollah and Hamas. They're slammed for their previous affinities with Irish republicanism and so on. Now, and Bernie Sanders, of course, we want him to go further on certain things, but he's been the foremost voice in the U.S. Congress, again, very low bar, advocating for Palestinian rights, advocating to end the slaughter in Yemen, advocating against war in Iran, and so on. So when it comes to the question of, well, are they taking an existing working class struggle and militancy in a politicized environment and channelizing to narrow ends? Well, I think that's just blatantly obvious that they're not doing that. You know, it's 2019 and we're in the United States. We're in a period of deep defeat and depoliticization. We're just getting out of this period. And it seems to me that what Bernie Sanders and what Jeremy Corbyn is doing is repoliticizing civil society, bringing back these ideas of socialism and class struggle, and encouraging people to demand more, to expect more, and reminding people that collective action is the route in which we actually get things done. Now, one reason why I spent so long talking about this dilemmas of social democracy is I think that if a movement like the Bernie Sanders movement is successful in the United States, eventually we will run into the same roadblocks that social democratic movements ran into in the 60s and 70s. But if you can't put something like Medicare for All on the table, we won't be able to put worker ownership of the means of production on the table. So it's a question of how do you repoliticize the working class? How do you rally people to actually make small gains and victories? And also reminding people that small victories beget more victories. You know, people, once they're organized together, once they see what happens when they fight together and they win something, they get more confident and they start to demand more things and they start to see themselves as agents of change. And if you would have asked me in, let's say, 2012, the first socialism conference I went to, you know, I would have told you kind of my old line as a socialist, which I still believe in the abstract, which is we organize in civil society, we increase the level of class consciousness and struggle in our workplaces, we organize our communities, we participate in social movements fighting against oppression, we embed ourselves in the working class. And then after this 5, 10, 15 years of patient organizing, any elections we run into, we'll be running elections to broadcast our ideas to more people and as measures of our strength. So elections would be like kind of temperatures or litmus tests of our level of organization, how successful we've been. I still believe that patient strategy in the abstract. But in practice, what we've seen in the United States, at least, is our program is already popular on a national level. Our immediate demands are popular on a national level. People want a jobs guarantee, they want child care, they want health care, they want a $15 minimum wage in a union, they want all these things. And they're voting for candidates like Bernie Sanders, like AOC, candidates that are running on these platforms. And these candidates are in turn encouraging people to organize and are participating in kind of this repoliticization of society. So it's up to us to actually fill this with substance. It's up to us to make independent movements from this from this moment. But in a way, it's kind of happening in the reverse order than what I expected. But as socialists, I think we need to have our theory of how we expect change to happen. But we also need to be ready to seize opportunities and to actually just follow the dynamics as they're happening. In Chicago, like, look at the way our kind of aldermen, the socialist aldermen in Chicago, behave. They aren't people who just say, you know, elect me and I'll take care of it. You know, these are people who are at protests, who are at union picket lines, who are encouraging people to be agents in their own liberation. And I think we need to figure out mechanisms to actually hold our elected officials accountable. We need to make organizations like DSA more coherent as far as under what criteria do we endorse people. Should we be endorsing people who aren't members? Should we be endorsing people who won't sign off on, let's say, 5 points of core principles? Should we be encouraging our electoral officials to caucus together and on certain key and important votes, vote together and block? Like, we need to be having these discussions, but there's no doubt in my mind that we should be taking advantage of these opportunities. And I'm less concerned with what the actual program of these people are as how they're fighting for it. So if you ask me if there's a difference, like, you know, obviously no one here would ask each other this, but maybe many of our friends will ask us, well, what's the difference between Warren and Sanders? They both say they want Medicare for all. You know, the difference is how they're going to fight for it, who's their agent of change, and, you know, and that, do they have kind of a theory of politics? And that's what I'm interested in.
That's right. Well, great. I think that's a good place to pause for a second. Let's thank Bhaskar Sankara.